Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, welcome everybody to another episode of The Grueling Truth. I'm your host, Mike Goodpaster. And as always, I would like to welcome in my co-host, Matt Andruskevich.
Thanks a lot, Mike. Always good to be here. I'm excited to talk about the NFL and many other things.
Well, our guest tonight played for almost a decade in the NFL, one of the best fullbacks in the NFL, and I think played 8 or 9 years, including helping the New England Patriots to win Super Bowl 36 as their starting fullback. I'd like everybody to welcome into the show Mark Edwards.
Hey, yeah, glad to be here. And I'm not sure I was one of the best fullbacks in the NFL, but I was serviceable for 9 years. How's that?
Oh, you were pretty good. I'm a Notre Dame fan, though, so I'm biased.
Welcome to the show, Mark.
I'm happy to be here, Matt.
Hey, well, we'll start off with that. You went to Notre Dame. I know you attended Norwood High School, where you set about every record known to man that I think still exists there. But coming out of Norwood, what made you want to attend Notre Dame instead of like an Ohio State?
Well, Notre Dame was the total package as far that fit me the best. It was within 4 hours of home, Notre Dame, and, you know, it had a come off national title in 88. I was 93, and, you know, they were competing for the national title, one of the top teams in the country every single year. I was going to be on national TV every single week. I knew I was going to get an education. I knew I was going to graduate. I knew there was a heck of an alumni network for once I did graduate, because obviously, in high school, yeah, you have dreams of playing in the NFL, but you don't really know where that's going to lead. But overall, it was by far the best all-around place for me. The way that Holtz used the fullback was, fit my skill set just perfectly. And at Ohio State at the time, that was back when John Cooper was there, and if I would have went to Ohio State, I would have been more of a mule blocker for Eddie George. I would have been a glorified offensive lineman in the backfield. I don't know if you remember, Mickey Sualua was the fullback during those years where I would have been there. And he didn't touch the ball a whole lot. So it was a much better fit for me at Notre Dame, where Holtz used a much more athletic fullback.
Mark, welcome to the show tonight. Really glad to have you on. Who were some of the early influences you had as a football player?
Obviously, my high school coach had a lot to influence me quite a bit. Jim Barry, he was been in Norwood for 10 or so years, and he went on and coached Wyoming with his brother Vernie Barry for a few years as well. But he was a big influence, and he obviously, Coach Earl Moseley, he was my running back coach at Notre Dame. As well as Coach Holtz. I mean, we can talk more about him in a little bit. But really, I think once I got to the pros, the guy that really helped me out the most was my running backs coach, my rookie and second year in San Francisco, which was Tom Rathman, who obviously was somebody that I looked up to growing up, outside of, his 49ers beating my Bengals in 88. But
I hear you.
But Tom really showed me what it took to be. At Notre Dame, I ran the ball real well. I caught the ball. I blocked, well enough. But I wasn't a very good lead blocker. Blowing a guy out of the hole. I'd go and I'd cut a guy and I get the position block a guy real well. And I was strong enough in college. Stronger than those linebackers where I could control them real well. Whereas I got the NFL, that wasn't going to work because these guys were just animals. So he really, that first 4 or 5 weeks of the season, my rookie year, and really going into my second year when I was pressed in the starting role for the 49ers is really taught me how to be a lead blocker in the NFL, which was what I was lacking.
The game I remember most from your career at Notre Dame would have probably been the 95 win over USC. I know Notre Dame was a big underdog. I think it had been a while since USC had even beaten Notre Dame. but that was supposed to be the year where, you know, they were finally going to beat Notre Dame. You scored three touchdowns. And the thing I remember most is it was the first Notre Dame game I ever attended. Actually, it's the only one I've ever attended to this day. But I remember at the end of the game, you were the second player ever carried off the field after Rudy Rudiger after that game. Can you tell us some memories about that game and what it was like to be carried off the field at Notre Dame Stadium?
You know, it was a pretty surreal experience. It was one of those games. We had lost the opening game of the year that year to Northwestern, who at the time was, you know, everybody thought was terrible. Northwestern ended up going 11-1 that season. That was, Pat Fitzgerald and Darnell Autry, that group. I think it was Gary Barnett was still there. When Northwestern had this two really good years in a row. So we lost Northwestern, and then we lost at Ohio State. And, you know, obviously early in the year, we were struggling a little bit. And then USC comes in. We've beaten them, I think, 10 years in a row, and then we tied them the previous season. We beat them 11 years in a row and tied them. So it was something like that. USC hadn't beaten us in, 12 or 13 years. So they come in. It was John Robinson's first year there. First or second year there, I forget, but Keyshawn Johnson, senior year, they were number 5 in the country. They were like 7-0. We were 5-2, and it was the year they were finally going to beat Notre Dame, and they came in on a chilly, crisp October day when it was a little bit misty out, kind of a overcast, and we just put one on them. I mean, offensively, defensively. Special teams, we just played a great all-around game, and by the end of the game, I had 38-10, I think, was the final, and I had a good all-around solid game, a couple touchdowns. I threw for a two-point conversion. I ran for a two-point conversion, had 70, 80, 90 yards rushing, 30, 40 yards receiving, and just a all-around gritty effort, really, by the entire team, because the guy that scores the touchdowns gets a lot of the accolades. I was the guy at the end that fans were picking up on their shoulders, and it was just a really, really cool experience. But all in all, I mean, it was just a great team effort. It was, I don't know if you remember that hit that Ken and Tatum put on their linebacker, put on their running back when they were getting ready to score the first touchdown. A ball pops loose. Defense had a great goal line stand right at the end of the first half to prevent them from scoring. And time ran out on them. I mean, it was just a really, really cool experience.
You mentioned legendary coach Lou Holtz as one of your early influences. What's your favorite memory of Coach Holtz while you were at Notre Dame?
Well, while I was at Notre Dame, I didn't have any favorite memory of Coach Holtz. you grow to appreciate him a heck of a lot more after you've already left Notre Dame. Holtz, it's like his philosophy was he put so much pressure on you during practice that come game time, it was a lot easier. He didn't yell and scream very much, if all. I mean, I remember maybe one time my freshman year he was yelling and screaming at halftime. But, I mean, it was all about making the adjustments and things like that at halftime. There wasn't a lot of yelling and screaming during the game. But, man, at practice, I mean, I used to remember as a freshman – really what he does is he puts so much pressure on you during the game or during practice, and he does that mainly to the underclassmen that are forced to play. He does it a little bit, once you're an established veteran, but he really puts all that pressure on the younger guys. So, like I said, once they get in the game, they don't feel as much pressure. And I remember as a freshman coming over to practice, and I wasn't a starter as a freshman, but I played, a significant amount of time. I remember just dreading going over to practice. I was walking over there because I knew I was going to get chewed out and embarrassed by Coach Holtz. I didn't know what it was going to be for. I didn't know when it was going to happen, but I knew something was going to happen at some point that was going to set him off and I was going to get my backside chewed out. And he was such a stickler to details. If I was in my stance and, I was supposed to take a lead step with my right foot, and instead I took a crossover step with my left foot to start the play, regardless of the outcome of the play. He was down the field chewing me out if I didn't step with the right foot to start the play. So that was my lasting memory. That and how many times my freshman year that he sent me down to scout team, because You know, the offensive, you know, field would be, you know, practice on one field, defensive practice two fields away. So there was a good, you know, 150 yards in between the fields. And whenever this offensive guy, and Holtz was always the offense, he was never down with the defense. So, you know, whenever you messed up, you know, the defensive guys would see you jogging down there. They knew that, that it was kind of like a jog of shame because, you know, they knew you'd screwed up for Holtz to send you down the scout team.
Well, I grew up, like I said, my whole life I've lived in Indiana, so Notre Dame was a big thing. I remember late 70s, even early 80s, watching Lindsey Nelson every Sunday morning with the Notre Dame replay show. Were you a Notre Dame fan when you were a kid?
I was exactly the opposite. Here's a good story for you. 1989, I'm a freshman in high school. I'm rooting for the University of Miami to beat Notre Dame and stop their 23-24 game win streak, whatever it was. Now, you know, maybe it was kind of like the New York Yankees effect where, you know, they'd been winning for so much since I was, you know, 2 or 3, 4, 5 years, and I just got tired of it, and I didn't like them because of it. I don't know why, but, you know, fast forward, you know, another 2 years, my junior year, when I'm starting to get recruited by them. And then, you know, like I was talking about, you know, the reasons earlier why I went there. I mean, all that stuff kind of started popping in my head, and I'm thinking to myself, you know what, this is kind of a no-brainer. This is where I need to go, period. This is the right place for me. Now, you know, fast forward to signing day, or shortly after signing day, in February and March of my senior year, after I signed a letter of intent, I'm looking back through some of my old folders and things like that from high school, and I found a folder that I had written on Notre Dame sucks. And it just, you know, it's kind of almost came full circle there from when I didn't like Notre Dame to now seeing, you know, maybe being envious of Notre Dame to being accepted by Notre Dame and being part of that, and then now having a lifetime of love affair with Notre Dame.
Yeah. At Notre Dame, the main play I remember from you was the run. I believe it was in 95 against Texas. That's probably what everybody talks to you about. But I mean, does any one game stand out as the best game you ever played while you were at Notre Dame?
You know, there were several that I really look back on, and you know, just where I got into the zone, I guess, you know, or the team was. I mean, obviously, you know, that game we already talked about, the game versus USC in 95, and I actually followed that up. I don't remember if we played USC or Boston College first, but it was back-to-back weeks. You know, the Boston College games where I had my best rushing game ever. And after coming off the two losses to Boston College when they basically, you know, stripped me of my national title in 93, and then 94 we went back to Chapel Hill or Chestnut Hill and just got blasted at Boston College my sophomore year. So coming in, that was in 95 in junior year when Boston College came back to South Bend, and we just did it. We only beat them 20-10, but we just absolutely destroyed them up front. I mean, we dominated that game, both lines of scrimmage. I had 160-some yards rushing, which was actually my only 100-yard game I ever had. I had a bunch of games in the, you know, 80s and 90s, yard rushing range, but that was my only game I ever had 100 yards. And obviously, the Texas game was a big one, both my junior year and my senior year in Austin. I mean, it was a great game in my senior year as well when we won on the last second field goal. So that was, so those were the, you know, kind of the four games that kind of stick out in my memory.
Now, Mark, you mentioned how growing up you're a Bengals fan. You know, from a fan standpoint, you know, the fan inside of you, what was it like to be drafted by a team that, you know, beat your team in the Super Bowl? And I only ask that because, like, I've always wondered, like, you know, if you're growing up liking a certain team, what happens when you get drafted by, like, a rival or something? What goes through your mind for something like that?
You change allegiances real, real quick. That's basically what it comes down to. At that point, you know, I didn't really that kind of thought never, ever crossed my mind. I was excited and thankful You know, I was a the 55th overall pick. So I was the 25th pick of the second round back when the NFL only had 30 teams, and you know, I was just excited to get my career started. And quite frankly, I didn't care where it was, but it was a little bit nicer that I was on a team that had a history of winning. I knew I was going to have the opportunity to compete for a Super Bowl title pretty quickly, which, you know, my rookie year, we lost in the NFC Championship game. Then my second year, we lost in the divisional round after winning the wild card game. We lost the divisional round to the Dirty Birds and Jamal Anderson in Atlanta.
Oh.
So, you know, the childhood allegiances left my thought process real quickly.
Well, I can tell you this. As a Cincinnati Bengals fan, I was cheering for the Dirty Bird on that one, Mark. I'm sorry.
Of course you were.
You remember in that game, like the first series of the game, Garrison Hurst broke his ankle.
Oh.
And we ended up losing that game 20-18. Had he not done that, you know, very well could have been a different outcome.
Well, in typical Bengals, they had Garrison Hurst, I believe, in 96 and let him get away. I still never understood that one. But all right, you talked about the draft. I mean, what was your draft day like in 1997?
Well, you know, now had to do it all over again, you know, I would, go out on the golf course and stay out there all day and, like, you know, have a cell phone on me and get the call, because I had a big party. We went down to Montgomery Inn Boathouse in downtown Cincinnati. We had the whole upstairs, all my friends and family and all that. Got down there at noon when the draft started, all right, and all day long, you know, we were watching the draft, and your people were coming up to me. Who do you think is going to be? I have no idea. You know, you get the same stuff, and everybody else is drinking and having a good time. So, you know, we get, you know, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock. Everybody, you know, was a little overserved by that time, and it was getting real annoying for me. But it was a very nervous day, you know, just waiting for the call, and the way I found out was actually pretty cool, because ESPN stopped the draft, the draft stopped airing on ESPN, I want to say, at 7 o'clock, and it switched to ESPN2. So the place didn't get ESPN2, so the owner is just frantically on the phone with the cable people trying to get, you know, the ESPN2 and this, that, and the other, and they didn't get it in time. So all of a sudden the owner goes, "Hey, Mark, you got a phone call." And, like, the whole place goes dead silent, which was really cool. And I pick up the phone. "Thank you very much, sir. Oh, I'm very excited," blah, 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 you know, so forth and so on. And nobody knew who it was yet. So I hang up the phone. I had 3 boxes of hats in front of me, you know, obviously all 30 teams. So I finger through the first hat. I can't find it. I finger through the second hat. I couldn't find it. I found it in the third box, and I just paused and then popped it on real quick, and the whole place went crazy, which was really cool. But, like I said, going back that whole day, I was just a dang wreck, and, you know, I should have been out somewhere else with keeping my mind occupied, opposed to, you know, thinking about this all darn day long.
Now, moving on to your career with the 49ers, you know, you had your rookie year in 97 behind William Floyd.
William Floyd, yep, William Floyid.
And then in 98, you get the – William Floyd moves on. You get penciled in as a starter. In the wild card game, I can pretty much recall this game almost play-by-play from memory, especially that final drive.
Yeah.
It was amazing as they, you know – Favre leads them down. They score the go-ahead touchdown and got, like, just over a minute to go. A couple completions to J.J. Stokes, and then what looks to be a really rough play is you catch the ball a few yards behind the line of scrimmage, and then Leroy Butler looks like he's going to make a play. And you end up making probably the real key play to set up the rest of the drive. Do you have any memories about that last drive? Anything you'd like to share about that play or anything on that?
Yeah. You know, I get people who text me or give me a call from time to time. "Hey, Mark, turn on ESPN Classic. You know, that You know, the catch two is on. So, I want to say it was like a second down. It was a second short, like second two or something like that. Steve Young was under a little bit of duress, and I was pass blocking. And, you know, I see him start to scramble a little bit, so I just kind of, you know, turn around, and he dumps me a pass about 4 yards, 4 or 5 yards deep in the backfield, and Roy Butler hits me immediately. You know, I was strong enough to stay on my feet and fortunate enough to shake him off, and then two other guys come charging at me, so I sidestep them, and Leroy takes a second crack at me and shake him again, and I break away for, you know, it was probably only a, you know, 5 or 6, you know, maybe an 8 yard gain when it was all said and done. But basically it took us from a, you know, a third and, you know, 7 or 8 to, you know, a fresh set of downs. And as we were on the 25 yard line with 8 seconds left, it turned out that those yards were pretty key with Terrell Owens catching that touchdown, that 25-yard touchdown pass with, you know, I think it was, like I said, with 8 seconds left from Steve Young. So it turned out to be more important than you thought. It was kind of one of those plays that, you know, as you're going through it, you know, you don't think it's that big of a deal, but looking at how things ended up, turned out to be a pretty, pretty key play.
Well, then we'll jump ahead. You played for the New England Patriots during the Spygate scandal. Do you have any insight or any stories about the allegations?
Well, I was there before the alleged Spygate, but I will tell you this. The second year I was in New England, you know, we had the magical run in 2001. You know, Bledsoe gets hurt, Brady comes in, we go on to win a Super Bowl over the Rams. So we open up the next season at home. Gillette Stadium is opening up, very first game in Gillette Stadium ever, because we played in the old Foxborough Stadium in 2001. And we're playing the Pittsburgh Steelers. It's a tough game, kind of going back and forth the first half. You know, we're up, I want to say we're up 10-7 to going in halftime. But the last drive of the first half, you know, we went into the two-minute offense. And apparently, you know, we had some eyes on their sideline, because we kind of figured out what their calls were by the cards they were hanging up, cards they were putting up, their defensive calls and things like that. So the second half we come out, and we come out in two-minute, no-huddle offense. And, you know, we have somebody up there that's looking at what the Pittsburgh Steelers are holding up, and Charlie Weiss is, on the walkie-talkie talking to Tom Brady. All right, Tom, they're in cover two. The Will and the Mike are blitzing. This is the play we're running. Throw it right here. And we just went up and down the field on them in the entire second half. So that was the kind of Spygate stuff that kind of went on. And, you know, call that Spygate or call that, you know, outsmarting your opponent. So, you know, you make your own choice there.
Well, I think the Spygate thing is overblown anyways. We talked about that last week when we talked. Every team tries to get an advantage. It's just most of them aren't as smart as Bill Belichick.
Coach Belichick, you know, it was always so interesting when we come in on Wednesday and start the game planning, because he was coming up with stuff every week, you know, offensively, defensively. You know, Charlie Weiss, you know, back then had a lot to do with that as well. But, you know, there's always something that they had that was unique, different. And a great example of that is, you know, obviously that year we won the Super Bowl. We played the Rams, I think it was in week 10. And that was our last loss. They beat us in Foxborough on a Sunday night. And we probably blitzed 75-80% of the time against the Rams. And they didn't put up huge offensive numbers. I think they beat us 24-17. But, you know, it was one of those games where it was never really in doubt. You know, they kind of controlled the game. But we blitzed, like I said, 75-80% of the time. Fast forward to the Super Bowl, Belichick completely changes his game plan. And what was interesting is we were only rushing three guys almost the entire game. And as the week was going on in practice, I was seeing what they were doing. And it was, and I was like, wow, that is just brilliant. Even though we're only rushing three guys, whichever way Marshall Faulk would release, that defensive end would stop rushing and basically just tackle him, hit him, slow him down, break his rhythm. But that's how they took Marshall Faulk out of that game. And if you remember, you know, a lot of people won't remember this, but, you know, we were beating them, I want to say, we were up 14-3, you know, early in the fourth quarter. The Rams were finally putting together a drive, and they had the ball fourth and goal on the two-yard line, and they decided to go for it. We have everybody covered. Kurt Warner takes off running. Roman Pfeiffer tackles him. He fumbles. Tabucky Jones picks the ball up, goes 99 yards the other way for a touchdown. Essentially, the game's over, but there's a flag on the field. Willie McGinnis had basically tackled Marshall Faulk coming out of the backfield, and that's what we were doing all game long. That was the only time they called it.
All right. Right now, the listeners are listening to the live show. Remember, at the bottom of the hour, in about a little over 4 minutes, we will go to archive time. You can go to the top of the hour at midnight, listen to a complete interview then. Don't forget, we have a special edition of The Grueling Truth tomorrow at 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll have a former Oakland Raiders coach, head coach, Tom Flores here. Won two Super Bowls with the Raiders, Super Bowls 15 and 18. So we'll have a great show tomorrow. Don't forget, 2:30 tomorrow. All of our shows are podcasts. You can go back and listen. Over the last few weeks, we've had Gary Jeter, Roger Craig, Leon Searcy, LaVon Kirkland, of course, Mark Edwards. So, Matt, you got the next one.
Mark, I think anybody who's either a fan of football or who's playing football all their lives with a dream of getting into the NFL fantasizes about what it's like to play in a Super Bowl. And you got to live out that fantasy. What was it like for you stepping on the field and just your game experience? What was that like for you?
Well, I mean, really the experience, you know, obviously the entire week's different, but I mean, I'll fast forward to game day. The thing that the coaches were trying to relay to us was that everything is slower. Everything takes longer on game day. You know, all the hype leading up to it and all that, it's like you got to find a way to relax your mind, relax your body during the day because, you know, it'll wear you out, you know, being that emotionally involved all day long. So, you know, the pregame, you have to go out for pregame earlier than you normally would. You know, once you go out onto the field, the national anthem and everything else takes longer. Halftime takes so much longer. So, you know, what they really needed you to emphasize, you know, was, you know, controlling your emotions over that longer time frame than what you were used to. And it was just absolutely, you know, an emotional day all around, you know, because, you know you're playing the biggest game of your life. Many guys get there, or many guys never get there. Some guys get there and one time and never get back. So, you know, you know the importance of it. You know just how big it is. And you want to try to take advantage of it and prepare for it the best you've ever prepared for anything. And you go out there and you try to play every play like it's the best you've ever played. But, you know, quite honestly, once, you know, after the introductions, you go out there after the kickoff, you know, it's back to playing football again. The one thing that was interesting that was a little bit different because it was at a neutral field, obviously, is that there's crowd noise for both teams, whereas normally there's only crowd noise for one team. But, I mean, other than that, it's out there, you're out there, you're playing football. You know it's a bigger game than you ever played, but once again, you know, once that whistle goes off, you're in there playing ball.
All right. I asked a question about Bill Belichick earlier. I think he's one of, if not the greatest football coach in NFL history. I mean, if you look at now compared to, say, when Lombardi coached, Lombardi didn't have to overturn a third, sometimes a little bit more of his roster. Just talk a little bit about what it was like to play for Bill Belichick and what made him different from other coaches.
You know, the thing about Belichick is what you see, you know, on TV, I mean, that's Bill. You know, everything outside of you being dedicated to football upsets him, all right? He doesn't want to deal with it. He doesn't like, you know, the media stuff. He doesn't like, you know, making appearances and all that stuff. You know, he wants to coach football. It's number one thing in his life, you know, and he pretty much thinks that you should feel the exact same way. And if you don't make it a priority, then you're out of there, period. you know, guys being late, guys not, you know, studying the film, guys not being mentally prepared, all that stuff just irritates him beyond belief. And, you know, you know that. I mean, what you see is what you get. He's not a yell and scream type of guy, but he's the type of guy, you know, that can talk to you in a normal tone and basically cuss you out in a normal tone and intimidate the heck out of you. Yeah, you know, because he is just he's smarter than everybody else. And not only that, but he works harder than anybody else. You know, he finds the little things in the rule book that you can take advantage of. And obviously, this year was another example in the playoff game versus Baltimore. I mean, he found something nobody else knew about, and they changed the rule because of it. Now, you know, they changed the tuck rule because of us. You know, so. But, you know, Belichick is, you know, the other thing that he really does uniquely is if you look at the guys on his roster, you know, on a year-in, year-out basis, you're going to find more college graduates on the Patriots than you are generally on the other teams around the league. So he gets guys that buys into the system, guys that will do what their coach, what he coaches them to do, and he gets more guys to do that than anybody.
All right. I got a follow-up here. I just got a message from somebody on Twitter that's listening to the show that has to be an Oakland Raiders fan. And he wants to know if when that play happened, if you thought it was a fumble or not.
I don't make the rules. I only play by them. So that's where I'll leave it at.
All right. Well, we'll read between the lines with that then, Mark.
I don't make the rules. I only play by them. That was the rule, so, you know, it is what it is. Another
Fair
one of Bill Belichick's famous line, it is what it is. You heard a lot of that.
You know, Mark, when you were playing at Notre Dame, that was pretty much the way the fullback was traditionally used, like Mike Allstott, or, you know, going back in the 70s with like a Larry Zonka. What are your feelings on how the fullback position, the way it's evolved over time and kind of what it is now?
Well, it breaks my heart, just like the move to field turf has broken my heart, specifically at Notre Dame Stadium. But, you know, in the name of progress, I guess, that's, you know, both the fullback position, the field turf, things like that, you know, need to change. I don't think it'll ever get back, the fullback position will ever get back to what it was in the 80s and 90s and, you know, kind of, you know, back when I was playing. I think it'll come back more than it is now, you know, because you'll see, I mean, you know, the teams that are generally the most successful or have been winning Super Bowls, I mean, you know, you see Seattle, you know, fullback, you know, a couple years ago, with Baltimore winning the Super Bowl, they used the fullback quite a bit. San Francisco, when you know, they were right up top, you know, last, you know, 2 years ago, fullback. You know, New England doesn't always, but you know, they also got Tom Brady, you know. But, you know, the fullback will come back a little bit more. It's not going to be fun and gun all the time, but it's never going to come back to, you know, what it was. And, you know, it breaks my heart to see that, but, you know, that's the evolution of football.
You mentioned Tom Brady there. I mean, what was it like to be on the same field with a guy that you, I mean, well, back then, did you guys yeah, realize how great he was going to be?
Well, you can't. I mean, what was kind of cool, and you saw early on, was when I got there. Let's even rewind to even before I got there. The year 2000 was Belichick's first year. He drafted Brady in the sixth round. The only reason Tom Brady made that team in 2000 was because Belichick kept four quarterbacks. You had Drew Bledsoe. I think it was John Freeze. Michael Bishop was the number three guy, and Brady was the fourth guy. So go to the next year. Freeze, you know, was a free agent. He went somewhere else. Michael Bishop was still on the team, but he ended up getting cut after training camp. Belichick brought in Damon Jewett along from Miami along to be the backup quarterback, along with a bunch of us free agent guys like myself and Mike Compton and Mike Vrabel, guys like that. And you know, Brady went into training camp as a third team quarterback, and he beat out Damon Jewett clearly. I mean, he was just you saw him really starting to rise. But Bledsoe had just signed a $100 million contract. He wasn't going to, you know, beat out Bledsoe. So, you know, you go into that second game, Bledsoe gets hit in the chest by Mo Lewis as he's running out of bounds at the end of the game. You know, TV didn't do it justice. When I was standing there, it sounded like, you know, Mo Lewis hit him with a shotgun shell. You know, that it was just the most horrific sound I'd ever heard. And, you know, Bledsoe shears a blood vessel in his chest, and in steps Brady. We just kind of slowly start winning. And the New England Patriots offense back when I was there, our core offense, our core personnel was two tight ends, two backs, and receiver, Troy Brown. We ran the ball with Antoine Smith. We ran the ball, and we play action the heck out of it. Brady was throwing for 190 to 220 yards a game, one touchdown. You know, we weren't making him win ball games back then. We were winning with offense, defense, and special teams. You know, we were number 18 in the league in offense that year. We were number 15 in the league in defense, but we were top five in the red zone on both sides, and in turnover margin. So, you know, you saw Brady as a game manager kind of the first year, you know, and then you started seeing flashes of it where he would bring us back from, you know, a deficit. You know, we were down by 10 with like 8 minutes to go against San Diego, and it was Brady's first 300-yard game, you know, that year. But you saw glimpses of what it could be. You know, he had great field presence and stuff like that, but he wasn't the Tom Brady that we know now that's, you know, throwing for, you know, 300-400 yards a game and being the best quarterback in the history of the league, or certainly in the conversation. But you started seeing glimpses of it then.
I have a question here. I mean, I remember the AFC Championship game that year. Brady got hurt, I think, around halftime. Mm-hmm. Bledsoe came in. You guys came back, won the game. Was there any, I mean, noticeable friction between the two the weeks leading up to the Super Bowl?
No. I mean, you know, Brady was healthy. He was going to play. Bledsoe knew that. Bledsoe did the right thing that year, and he, you know, sucked up his pride. He played the team guy. You know, maybe there was a conversation between him and Belichick or something that, hey, you know, stick out this season. You know, we're going to trade you. We're going to put you in a better, you know, situation is better for you. If, you know, do what's right this year. I don't know if that conversation went on or not, but Bledsoe, you know, he sucked it up, and you know what, he gave it up for the team that year, and. Yeah, I mean, obviously he wanted to play in the Super Bowl, you know, after coming back in that AFC Championship game and you know, leading us to victory. But if Brady was able to play, he was going to play, and that was just the end of it.
You know, besides winning the Super Bowl, do you have a favorite memory of your career that stands out to you?
NFL-wise, I mean, not really. I mean, yeah, that was the pinnacle of it. You know, going in my rookie year and playing with a lot of legends was pretty cool as well. You know, a team that we lost in the NFC Championship game to Green Bay and Brett Favre, but that team had Steve Young and Jerry Rice and Brent Jones, Kevin Gogan, the offensive line, you know, Terrell Owens, Garrison Hurst was the was the tailback of that team. And then you look at my defensive side of the ball, Dana Stubblefield, Brian Young. Yeah, Kevin Green on that team. Goodness. Ken Norton
Rod
Jr.,
Woodson.
Burton Hanks, Tim McDonald. I mean, on and on. I mean, you know, just Rod Woodson was on that team, you know, towards the end of his career as well. I mean, you know, playing with those guys, you know, as a rookie was pretty darn intimidating. And but at the same time, you know, it prepared me for, you know, the rest of my career, you know. So, you know, but obviously the Super Bowl was by far – the you know, just that run my 2 years in New England, because, you know, most of the teams I played for, you go out, you practice, you go in the locker room, shower up, you go watch film, and then, you know, get out there as fast as you could. When I was in New England, you know, we had a great locker room, a great group of guys. white guys, black guys. I mean, it didn't matter. I mean, you know, veterans, rookies, everybody hung out. You know, after practice, we'd shower up, watch film. We'd go back to the locker room. We'd hang out for an hour, hour and a half. We'd play games. We had, you know, a bunch of game tables set up in the middle of the locker room. And, you know, I learned to play dominoes, you know. Big offensive line, you know, a bunch of guys playing back game. We'd all hang out and we'd, you know, bust on each other. And we'd go out. We'd have our own team parties that weren't that we would organize. Nothing to do with the organization itself, but the players would organize them. And, you know, every Friday night we had, you know, anywhere between 8 and 10, 12 guys would go out with, you know, either girlfriends or their wives, whoever. And we'd all, you know, go down to Boston or downtown to Providence and have dinner. And we would just hang out during the season and the off season. It was just a real close group of guys.
Well, we've got about 2 minutes left. Final question. What are you doing nowadays since you've retired?
Well, mostly I am chasing my kids around the soccer field and, you know, being a soccer dad. I have 4 children. My oldest two are I have 3 daughters, 16, 14, and 11, and I have a little boy who's 5, and the older two are pretty darn good travel soccer players, and my oldest one's starting the recruiting process, so that's exciting. But after I finished with the NFL, I was kind of trying to find myself. I kind of got involved in I had a supplemental insurance company that I was part owner of, so I tried to go that route a little bit and got my Series 7 and my insurance licenses and realized that wasn't for me real quick. So I transitioned into this company called Speed Shield that was a startup at the time. They have a safety and efficiency device for forklifts, kind of like a black box system, so somebody can look at their entire fleet online if they hit something. Emails are going out and, you know, the unit can shut off and things like that. And I've since taken that, and now I work with I have my own little company that I work with forklift dealers around the country installing that system and implementing it and teaching the online system and things like that. A lot of travel.
Hey, and of course the final question is this: are you still a Cincinnati Bengals fan?
You know, I do have a soft spot for the Bengals. I'll root for them, but, I guess, you know, the team I most associate myself with is the Patriots because I had my best time there, my most success there. But I am a Reds fan, and I did listen to the opening day game 2 days ago.
Well, I think last time I saw it was 3-3. It's like they're playing a West Coast game in Cincinnati tonight because they had a 3-hour rain delay.
I saw there was a rain delay, and the last I saw was like a second inning, and the Reds were up 1-0. But I'll take a look at it.
Todd Frazier hit a home run. Here.
Oh, nice, yeah. Nice.
But, hey, at least you didn't say you were a 49er fan. So.
No. I had a great time out there, but, yeah, although I guess a lot of people associate the Patriots now as the new hated team around the country just because they've been so good for so long, you know.
Well, hey, it was an honor talking to you tonight. Anytime you want to come back, if you want to come back, be on our draft show, or you want to talk during the season a little bit, we would love to have you back on. I mean, I think this was a great interview. Matt?
Really enjoyed hearing all your thoughts about your whole career, Mark. I've always been a fan of yours.
Always fun to talk about that stuff, relive those memories, and shoot me a note, man. I'll hop on anytime with you.
All right.
Appreciate
thanks
it.
A lot, Mark.
You bet, guys. Appreciate it, man.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
All right. Remember, guys, tomorrow at 2:30 on The Grueling Truth, a special Thursday episode with legendary, I think should be Hall of Fame coach Tom Flores, who won 2 Super Bowls with the Oakland Raiders, and then I think Super Bowl 18 was the L.A. Raiders. I mean, I know I'm excited about the show tomorrow. How about you, Matt?
Definitely. You know, Tom Flores is one of those guys that I don't know how he's not in the Hall of Fame. It'd be good to get his thoughts about his career.
Well, and tomorrow night, we will have a Thursday night edition of The Grueling Truth where instead of having another 49er on, I figured we might as well talk to, you know, more important players. So we'll have, from the Super Bowl 23 Cincinnati Bengals, linebacker Joe Kelly will be with us tomorrow night. So now you'll actually get to talk to a real legend, a Cincinnati Bengal, Matt.
That's right. I can't wait to ask him about his thoughts on Super Bowl 23.
Well, I mean, there's really nothing to think about Super Bowl 23. I think we'd talk. I think we'll talk about everything but Super Bowl 23.
Of course we will.
Nah, I think probably half that interview will be Super Bowl 23 because I have a lot of questions that have been bothering me since I was little that I've been having nightmares about.
That'll be a good time.
But, hey, we will see you guys tomorrow. Remember.